You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning if you are on the other side of the international dateline in the Pacific. My name is Gordon Peake. I am Senior Advisor on the Pacific Islands at United States Institute of Peace, and I'm delighted to be comparing this event today, this virtual event, with two people whose work I admire and respect tremendously. It is the topic of the talk is on the screen, which is statecraftiness mapping power and influence in the Pacific Islands, a very timely topic, a very important topic, a very resonant topic in today's geopolitical times. I'm going to talk a little bit about what the United States Institute of Peace is, and then I'm going to hand over to my two distinguished colleagues, Professor Joanne Wallace of University of Adelaide, a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings Institution, and Dr. Henrietta McNeil from the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University in Canberra. And I want to thank them both for doing the early shift for us this morning. It's late afternoon here, but it's very early in Australia. So who are we at USIP? We're a national, nonpartisan, independent institute that was founded by Congress. We work all over the world, including in the Pacific Islands. And you can see some of the details of our Pacific Islands work on our website. We work in the field by testing ideas and developing programs, and we also conduct research and analysis. And we also are a forum for discussing really important, timely ideas in Washington, D.C. And in the 3 years that I've been at the Institute, the Pacific Islands has become ever more a central part of the discussion. Previously, maybe 10 years ago, it would have been a peripheral part of discussion on geopolitics, but is ever more at the front and center, this region of the world that makes up one-third of the world's mass and is a supercharged in attention over the last sort of three to four years. And I was delighted to be involved in this project in a sort of supporting role. I helped deliver some podcasts for the project. But the lion's share of credit goes to Joanne, who helped conceptualize it and helped deliver it. And in many ways, I think was ahead of the curve in terms of thinking about what is it, there's so much work that's going on in the Pacific, but how much influence is this work generating? And Henrietta also contributed to the project in a number of ways, including writing a number of the research reports and editing a book that Joanne will be talking about momentarily. Just want to lay the table a little bit for how we're going to spend our time over the next hour. Joanne's going to speak first. She's going to share some slides from the project, a kind of tour to horizon of what we find in the project. And then Henrietta and I are going to have a conversation for about 10, 15 minutes about some of the interesting ideas and themes that emerge from the slides themselves and also from the work. We'd love it if you can contribute to the conversation. As I said, I've got a high respect for Joanne, I've got a high respect for Henrietta. We can definitely fill the time over the next hour, but we'd love it to get your ideas and perspectives and views as well. So I'd invite you to contribute questions as they come along into the chat. We'll curate and mediate those questions, and I will ask them to Joanne and Henrietta as appropriate. I'll probably sort of give you both the opportunity to figure out who's best placed to tackle what questions. So without further ado, I'm going to sort of cue the slides and hand it over to you, Joanne. Good morning in Adelaide, where it's 5:30 a.m., so real kudos to you for joining us. Thank you, Joanne. Over to you.
Thanks, Gordon, and thank you very much for having us, and thank you to USP for hosting this presentation of our project. So as Gordon said, I'm going to speak for a few minutes with some slides that show the major findings from our project before Henrietta and I delve into some discussion with Gordon about our findings. And as Gordon said, that Pacific leaders now describe the Pacific Islands geopolitical landscape as crowded and complex. There is a context of heightened strategic competition, and partner states are seeking to improve their relationships and reputations in the region by a series of visits, assistance, and other mechanisms. But all this urgent energy poses risks. It's been difficult to track what partner state is doing what and where they're doing it. And we've been concerned, and Henrietta and I had previously done another project on security cooperation in the region. And in that project, one of our major findings was our concern that many of the activities that partner states like the US, Australia, New Zealand, and others are conducting in the Pacific might be poorly targeted, duplicative, or overwhelming the absorptive capacity of Pacific Island countries. So to help address this, as Gordon said, between mid-2022, and we've just wrapped this, this is our last activity, our State Craftiness Project has created an interactive story map. The link to the story map is there on the website, on the slide, as is the link to our website, our project website, where all our findings and publications are. And I'll discuss in a moment our podcast. So basically, the story map is the major outcome from our project. It's an interactive online map that collates data on the major tools of statecraft being deployed by partner states in the region and where those tools are being deployed. It was accompanied by a podcast that features Pacific thinkers' reflections on being the targets of these statecraft efforts, and that was hosted by Gordon. I highly recommend turning to that. As it says on the slide, it's available on all major podcast platforms. Gordon produced two excellent seasons. He managed to get a huge range of different voices, both from the Pacific, but also from partner countries, about what it is like to be a statecraft actor and a statecraft target. And the fact that those two categories are not necessarily neat either. Often the targets turn it right back on their on the states that think that they're acting on them, and influence flows in both directions. We also produced a series of policy papers and journal articles. Again, these are linked to on our project website. And we have a book coming out on the 20th of November that I'll discuss a bit later. So in this presentation, I'm going to discuss our major findings. Unfortunately, because I didn't want to crash the internet, I've only taken screenshots from our story map, but I do suggest that you go to the story map itself to see the interactive elements. And we'll outline our recommendations about how scholars and practitioners can understand statecraft in the Pacific and the implications for the US and other partner countries' foreign and strategic policy. I will just note that this project has been supported by the Australian government through a grant by the Australian Department of Defence, but the views that we express today and in the project are ours, and they're not necessarily those of the Australian government or the Australian Department of Defence. So any assessment of the effectiveness of individual tools of statecraft needs to acknowledge that there's often no direct causal line between the deployment of a tool of statecraft and the advancement of a partner state's policy. Instead, in our project, we understand statecraft to describe actions that states take to try, they don't necessarily always succeed, to try to change three factors that determine the success of their foreign and strategic policy. So they try to change their external environment, the policies and behaviour of target states, actors, communities, or individuals, or the beliefs, attitudes, and opinions of those target states, actors, communities, or individuals. The converse is also true, though. Correlation between, for example, the deployment of tools of statecraft by a partner state and a change in the policies or behaviour of Pacific Island countries does not necessarily mean that one caused the other. There is no necessarily assumed unilinear effect between the deployment of a tool of statecraft and a change in the behaviour of a Pacific Island country target state. Whether statecraft and attempts at influence are successful is ultimately determined by their receptivity of partner states in the Pacific, sorry, of Pacific Island states. The policies and behaviour we need to remember of Pacific Island countries are determined primarily by domestic political imperatives. And this is really important to keep in mind when you might see something happen in the Pacific and assume that it was caused by the influence of perhaps the US, China, or Australia. Often when you delve deeper, it was actually a response to domestic issues primarily. Partner countries may have had some small role, but in many cases, they are co-opted or instrumentalized by domestic actors for their own ends. The agency of Pacific Island countries is very much what we need to keep in mind when we're seeking to understand power and influence in the Pacific. An example here is while the US's defence cooperation agreement with Papua New Guinea. We need to remember that although this was probably interpreted as a success in Washington and elsewhere in the US, it remains very unpopular domestically in Papua New Guinea. There is concern that it's going to draw Papua New Guinea into the militarisation of the Pacific. We need to remember here that Papua New Guinea is a long-standing member of the non-aligned movement, something that many influential people in Papua New Guinea take seriously. And remember that the constitutionality of potential immunities granted to American personnel is likely to be the subject of a court challenge. Recalling here that about 20 years ago, a similar immunity was given to Australian police. It was successfully challenged on constitutional grounds, and the Australian police had to withdraw. A similar case here is the Australia Vanuatu security agreement that was signed in late 2022. Again, that is also unpopular in Vanuatu, which is another member of the non-aligned movement. And it led ultimately and contributed to the loss of office of the Prime Minister at the time. A second finding is that the deployment of tools of statecraft have to be analysed in relative rather than in absolute terms. And here I've got on the screen is a map of the different military presence that is in the Pacific. And it's easy to draw incorrect and at times potentially catastrophizing conclusions when you look at one partner country's activities in isolation from others. But when you analyse those activities in comparison to other partner states, a more accurate picture emerges. An event that's motivated much of the recent interest in the region was the April 2018 rumour that China was seeking to establish a military base in Vanuatu. Those anxieties then escalated in April 2022 with the news that China and Solomon Islands had entered into a security agreement. There was a lot of concern and there were interpretations, despite that agreement never having been publicly released, unfortunately. There were interpretations that it might lead to a potential Chinese military presence in the region. But despite all the discussion about a potential Chinese military presence, what is often overlooked is the existing military presence of allies in the Pacific. So our story map shows that the US and France already have an extensive military presence in the Pacific and that they could scale that up quickly if needed. You just need to look at the US's activities in Guam, which continue to grow by the day and expanding now further into Palau, for example, to demonstrate that the US and France already have a very strong military presence in the Pacific. Australia also has an indirect presence through its Pacific Maritime Security Program, under which it provides patrol boats to the Pacific island countries and also provides with that Royal Australian Navy personnel who assist with the operation of those boats. Similarly, there are concerns that the China-Solomon Islands security agreement might have paved the way for the presence of Chinese police. And it's true that there have been very small deployments of Chinese police to Solomon Islands since the agreement. But this has been, again, we need to take into account here the relative versus absolute comparison. Our story map shows, and here I've got a screenshot of Australian policing. On the story map, you can go and see the policing presence of every partner state in the Pacific by country. And here you can see the Australian because it is the most prevalent. We are in practically every Pacific Island country providing police assistance. And when you look at that and you consider what the Chinese presence is, it's very small presence in Solomon Islands. There's also a policing agreement with Fiji that's been in place for about 13 years. You can see that it's nowhere near as broad reaching as that's the assistance provided by Australia and also by New Zealand. And our policing presence in Australia is just going to expand with the approval of the Pacific Policing Initiative at the recent Pacific Island Forum leaders meeting. Now, comparing the deployment of statecraft tools in relative terms suggests that there is an analytical focus on quantity. Now, we acknowledge that quantity is important, and our story map does tell a story about quantity. And when you visit it, you will see that we have mapped not only what is being provided, but the quantity of the statecraft tools that are being provided in our many categories of statecraft. But at the same time, we don't argue that quantity necessarily equates to the quality or effectiveness of those tools of statecraft. There's been an overemphasis, we argue, in our project on quantity by partner states that are keen to be seen to be doing something in response to China's activism in the Pacific. And this has unfortunately meant that small-scale programs run by civil society groups, they're often perceived as having less PR value, And it means that they're no longer receiving the funding that they're used to from traditional partners. This is even for inexpensive items like chairs, tables, computers to assist vulnerable communities. And this is something Henrietta, who's conducted field work more recently than me, has noticed in her recent visits, is that a lot of these things that were in the past were provided with donor funding are just not there. And you can't kind of underestimate the importance of having things like chairs, tables, fuel for vehicles that are just not being provided. I was just hearing the other day that Australia, for example, is now cutting back some of our health funding because we're focusing on infrastructure, because we want to be seen to be building something that we can put a label on. But, you know, health and education are just so critical in the Pacific. The irony here, of course, is often these small-scale programs are actually the most effective at delivering development and improving donor reputation. I would mention here that I work on a separate project called the Regional Perspectives Research Project. In that project, we've been working with partners in Solomon Islands and Vanuatu for the last 2.5 years, doing local perception studies amongst communities in all provinces and all levels of community in those two countries. And one of the major things they tell us is the visibility of donors is what gets noticed. And the visibility of donors in these small cases is actually incredibly important at a community level. You're not necessarily seeing the donors in building a big building in the capital, but you are seeing a donor who's out there providing assistance to the local school. So drawing on our story map, the difference between quantity and quality is well illustrated by diplomatic presence and visits. Australia is the only partner state with diplomatic posts in all Pacific Island countries, and we're followed closely here by New Zealand and then by Japan and China. The US has engaged in a recent surge of diplomatic post openings. At the same time, again, the number of posts doesn't necessarily equate to the quality or effectiveness of these posts. And this is because individuals, not policy, are the most important determinants of whether statecraft actually succeeds. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Henrietta has been leading some work on the role of individuals in statecraft, and we'll talk a bit about that later. The high-level visits to the Pacific by foreign leaders and officials are also mapped on our story map, and I've just taken, again, a screenshot excerpt here, but when you go to the story map, you can see every visit that has been made to the Pacific since 2018 by foreign leaders. We've seen Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, the US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, French President Emmanuel Macron, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, former British Foreign Minister James Cleverly, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi have all made appearances in the last couple of years. But again, quantity does not equal quality diplomatic relationships. The quality of the actual diplomats that you send really does matter. And here we recognise that diplomats are not carbon copies of each other. They all have their own foibles, habits, strengths and weaknesses. And their individual personalities are adjudicated and assessed very intensely in the capital cities where they work, as are those of the police officers that partner countries send, military officials and assorted contractors implementing their projects. And we argue that this highlights that ensuring that diplomats are well selected and prepared for the Pacific Island country to which they've been posted is critical. They need to be willing to develop relationships while they're there, and this is going to be essential to determining the quality of the diplomatic exchanges they engage in, and therefore the quality of the effectiveness of the statecraft that they achieve for their country. Beyond high-level diplomatic engagement, public diplomacy is an increasingly prominent tool of statecraft. And here we focused on social media because that's a very popular mechanism for partner state diplomats seeking to engage Pacific people. Social media followings have also been found in research to affect diplomatic negotiations, shape diplomatic influence outside formal meetings, and this is through the concept of soft power. So to try to understand the effectiveness of social media as a diplomatic tool, we've analysed the followings of different diplomatic missions in the region, and this is represented on the slide in the table. Again, there's an interactive version of this on the actual story map. As you'd expect, the countries with close relationships have high followers. So Australia has reasonably high social media reach across the Pacific, particularly in Papua New Guinea, which is our closest neighbour and our former colonial territory. The US also has large social media followings, particularly in Papua New Guinea, Timor-Leste and Solomon Islands. At the same time, social media engagement doesn't necessarily mean that people agree with or even think favourably of the country they follow. The large following of the US Embassy in Papua New Guinea, for example, could be due to the fact that there have been a number of recent controversies involving the mission in Moresby. And people might be going onto the US Facebook site because they want to talk about or hear about those controversies. Assessing the influence of diplomacy in the Pacific Islands region highlights the importance of analysing statecraft over the long rather than the short term. And we argue in our project that this was well illustrated by the US's response to the Solomon Islands China Security Agreement. After the agreement was signed, the US immediately sent senior diplomatic officials to Solomon Islands. But this was despite the fact that the US hadn't had a formal diplomatic presence in Solomon Islands for 29 years. So the US's long absence undermined the value of these high-level diplomatic visits because it's the quality of the relationships that determine far more than the might and money of the state that's visiting, what kind of outcomes are generated by those visits. I point here on the map, with Henrietta and our colleagues in the Pacific team at the University of Adelaide, they've written a paper about how Pacific Island countries are themselves conducting statecraft. And one of their main arguments is that the quality of relationships is key, and that quality is developed over the long term. Another aspect of those quality relationships is having knowledge of the region. And this is particularly the importance of Pacific literacy in partner countries, both in the political and official sectors and in the broader public. There are large Pacific diasporas in the US, Australia, and New Zealand, but there's still limited understanding of Pacific cultures and languages in those countries, including in policymaking and political circles. Language is critical to Pacific literacy, and it can really determine the effectiveness of diplomacy. We map on our story map the different language training that happens in partner countries, and we find that New Zealand by far and away does the most to promote Pacific languages. Several New Zealand universities have and teach a number of Pacific languages. Australia is less good in this regard. We really only teach Pacific languages at one university, the Australian National University. The situation is the same in the US. We could really only find Pacific languages taught at the University of Hawaii and the University of Guam. Here we also find that China has actually increased its language programs. Beijing Foreign Studies University teaches a range of Pacific languages, including ones that have only very few speakers in the Pacific, but you can actually find them being taught in Beijing. China's also established 7 centres dedicated to Pacific studies in universities across China. And something that we've found and that our colleagues in the Pacific have reported to us is that Chinese diplomats, when they arrive, are often fluent in Pacific languages. But there are often varying levels of language ability displayed by diplomats from traditional partner states. Beyond language, understanding is also developed through the media. Australia, China, New Zealand, US and UK all broadcast state media into the region, but by far the largest presence is by Australia and New Zealand media. US is really only via Voice of America that you can access on the internet, or maybe by channels like CNN that people can get if they can afford and they have access to a subscription television service. China State Television, China Global Television Network, is also broadcast in a number of Pacific Island countries, including in some cases on state broadcasting channels. And I direct you here to look out for a project that's just about to be published by ABC, which is Australian Broadcasting International, ABC International Development. A team of Pacific experts led by my University of Adelaide colleague Priestley Hubru has just finished reviewing the state of the media in the Pacific. And he and his team have prepared a regional report and 12 Pacific Island country reports mapping the information and media environment in the Pacific. And they will be published in the next month or a month or so by the ABC. And that really gives you a sense of the health of the media in the region, but also the presence of partner countries' media. And it has some quite surprising results, I say, as someone who's been lucky enough to see them. Other soft power tools such as scholarships, church networks, language training and cultural exchanges are also often overlooked. And again, this is all mapped on our story map. You can see where the church partnerships are and you can see where scholarships are being offered to Pacific Island students. And again, there's a paper that actually, again, Priestley Hubru, my colleague at University of Adelaide, and a group of Pacific students have prepared about the effect of scholarships on as a tool of statecraft and how effective or not they are as a tool of influence over Pacific their Pacific recipients and the Pacific more broadly. One of the challenges of compiling our story map and of analysing the deployment of tools of statecraft more generally has been distinguishing between the announcement and the implementation of tools of statecraft. Partner states deploy tools of statecraft because they want to improve their reputation and relationships. So they tend to announce these things through media releases and press conferences because they want to maximise the attention that they receive. This can mean that these announcements are interpreted as being more significant than their potential outcomes, because often the announcement is not actually implemented at all or not implemented fully. This has been well illustrated by several examples in the region, and I can speak to those in the Q&A if people are interested. Another challenge we've encountered is identifying the source of tools of statecraft. And this is because it can be unclear which partner country is funding the tool of statecraft. Now, China, in this case, subcontracts out the delivery of a statecraft to state-owned enterprises. Australia, New Zealand, the US provide a lot of their assistance via private contractors, NGOs, or multilateral institutions. And this can mean that the average person in the Pacific often doesn't realise that the assistance is coming from the US or Australia. Many local level health and education programs, when they are funded, are provided by NGOs such as World Vision or Save the Children. And one Pacific colleague commented to me a few years ago, and it's really stuck with me, that it's their T-shirts people see. Australia's name isn't anywhere. And it's helped, of course, by everyone knows that World Vision has bright orange T-shirts. But it's just a reminder that we can sit in Canberra or in Wellington and think that we're spending X million dollars on a health program, but the recipients have no idea that that program is being funded by Australia. So we can't necessarily equate the dollars that are being spent with any kind of outcome in terms of being influential. Our policing assistance in Australia is increasingly provided by private contractors. And it means that when the US or Australia tots up the value of all our assistance to the region, and we assume that by quantity and relative to other partner countries that we're doing a lot, the recipients of all this statecraft are often unaware of who's providing them. It can also mean that key messages that the US, Australia or other donors want to develop and deploy through their statecraft just gets lost because they're not being translated and relayed by the contractors that are delivering the statecraft. Another phenomenon, and I'm going to finish in a moment, is that the wrong partner state can get credit for providing a tool of statecraft. And this has really been an issue with infrastructure projects. You would have heard that that there's a lot of analyses that argue that through China's Belt and Road Initiative of funding infrastructure projects, China's engaging in something called debt trap diplomacy, trying to use its loans to leverage access for strategic ends. But a lot of infrastructure projects are being built by China. This is true. They're by Chinese state-owned enterprises, but most of them are funded by multilateral institutions such as the Asian Development Bank or the World Bank, rather than by the Chinese government. Chinese state-owned enterprises are building them because Chinese companies are often the sole bidders for infrastructure tenders. They also bid very low to secure contracts. Chinese companies have received 80% of Asian Development Bank contracts in Papua New Guinea, for example. But a lot of that Asian Development Bank funding actually comes from the US, Australia, and other partners. But we're not getting the credit for providing that. And that's something in Australia that's caused a lot of angst. Our Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, has been very vocal on this issue and is pushing to make that a change. So what should the US and other partners and allies do? So as I've argued, we find in our story map that these countries, Australia, New Zealand and the US, have by far the most extensive presence in the Pacific and deploy by far the greatest and most expensive and expansive range of tools of statecraft. And these partner countries do have legitimate strategic concerns. We don't in this project in any way diminish the concerns or undermine the concerns that Australia, in particular the US, New Zealand, have about China's increasingly visible presence in the region. But we do argue that Australia, the US and others have the time and the space to ensure that the deployment of our tools of statecraft in the Pacific is responsive rather than reactive. Instead of reacting to each Chinese announcement, which has been a phenomenon that has characterised Australian statecraft and the US statecraft in particular over the last 5 years, we need to shift to act to responding proactively. We need to recognise that there's a risk of overinterpreting the impact of tools of statecraft, particularly when we view them in isolation or in the short term. And we argue that Australia and the US need to take a much more long-term view and stop reacting and start being proactive about taking the initiative out of China's hands. And by collating the tools of statecraft being deployed by partner states, we hope that our story map offers a good place for partners to begin their responsive analysis. And I also just point here on the slide, we have a book coming out, as mentioned, on the 20th of November, which we delve into these issues more fully. And we also have published a policy paper that's available on our project website, where we again discuss these issues more fully. Thank you. I'll hand it back over now. Sorry, I spoke too long.
No problem. Thank you, Joanne. I mean, Joanne's industry puts us all to shame. She's also published a book that recently, along with a colleague, Rebecca Stratting, about maritime, Australia being surrounded by seas. And it's a really, really interesting and kind of different tilted look at sort of Australian security and Pacific security. So I commend that. I'll put it on the USIP bookshelf that we have behind me back there. Thank you, Joanne. That was just so much kind of food for thought in it. I mean, I was thinking as you were talking about this concept, of the signal and the noise. There's so much noise about statecraft presently and about initiatives, and it's impossible to keep track of everything that seems to be happening. And I think this project does a really good job of trying to have a clear signal that goes through everything. And I really commend everyone to take a look at the story map that Joanne referenced in her remarks. We could all get lost in maps, and I found myself getting lost in this map in the most healthy and good way, because you can see all the things that are going on, and you get to see trends. Like, I didn't really realize until looking at the map that Australia had a presence in each Pacific Island nation, New Zealand second. There's a great map of the Pacific Island Forum countries, but also all the countries that are dialogue partners and have various affiliations to the Pacific, everywhere from Norway to Chile. So it's a tremendous resource. And I think you could spend, just like looking at a good atlas, spending a lot of time on it. So we've got some terrific questions that we've seen come in on the chat, from a person called Elise, who we don't know the details of. But thank you, Elise. These are great questions that we're going to send to our colleagues. But I wonder if I can begin, maybe, Joanne or Henrietta, choose which one of you would like to go first. Is, noting that you say that it's hard to come up with a unilinear story of, cause and effect. But noting that, that I'm sitting talking to you in Washington, D.C., a place that is re-engaging with the Pacific, beginning under the Trump administration. My Secretary of State Pompeo was a Secretary of State that visited the freely associated states. President Trump had Pacific Island leaders in from three of the freely associated states in the White House. Then President Biden had two meetings with Pacific Island leaders in Washington, D.C. over the last few years. I'd love to get your assessment, noting that it's hard, that the danger of a single answer and a simple answer, of how U.S. statecraft is faring in the Pacific. As we know from your story map, the U.S. had a presence in large parts of the Pacific, a military presence, a diplomatic presence, over the years, but it's kind of ramping up in terms of new embassies that are being opened. One opened recently in Honiara after being closed for 29 years, maybe a little bit more. One opened recently in Port Vila and Vanuatu. We'd love to get your just assessment of where we are as we kind of close off 2024.
Henrietta, do you want to begin? Because I've spoken.
No, you go. No, it's fine. You go.
Okay. Look, the US, yeah, I mean, it's funny. I've done some other work, and there's a paper I published with my colleague Maya Mokoro late last year. And in that paper, we argue that in many ways, What's happened in the last few years has not been the influence of Pacific Island countries, it's been the influence of Pacific Island countries over the donors. And you can really see that in the case of the US. We had those two US Pacific Island country summits at the White House convened by President Biden, which was just unheard of. It was hard to imagine that something similar could have happened even a decade ago. So yeah, in many ways, the influence has actually been on partner countries to lift their game. And the US has definitely tried to do that. But the US has really done well on announcement, but very lax on in implementation. And that has been noticed in the Pacific. And for example, I mentioned those summits. At the first summit in September 2022, there was a whole raft of new announcements. I think it totted up to about $800 million US in total. Very few of those have actually been approved by Congress and therefore implemented. And that's noticed in the Pacific. You know, it's great to make the promise, but you do actually have to deliver. And in 2023, when the second summit was held, the then at the time Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare declined to attend the second summit. Now, a lot was made of that about, you know, a lot of accusations of Samare being China's man in the Pacific. And so forth. And it was assumed that China had influenced him not to go. But Samare did quite justifiably, you could argue, point out that, well, what's the point? We went the first time, they made a bunch of announcements and then they didn't deliver. Why would I go again? You know, when we still haven't had implementation of the first lot of announcements. Now, whatever his reasons for attending were, it wasn't an unjustifiable argument for Sogavare to make. So, you know, it's great that the US is more present. Yes, there are diplomatic present missions now, but they are very, very small. you know, yes, we do see Kirk Campbell in much in evidence at the Pacific Island Leaders Meeting. But again, the implementation is what matters. And I mentioned that other project that I work on called the Regional Perspectives Research Project. That's another project funded by the Australian Department of Defence. Again, though, entirely our work, not theirs. And again, one of the things that we've spoken to communities about in that project is what partner countries do you look to for assistance? And I don't think that of the many hundreds, and I'm talking 700 plus interviews and focus groups that we conducted for that project so far, I don't think the US has been mentioned once. It just has no real presence on the ground basis. Now, that would be different if we were doing that research in Palau or Marshall Islands or one of the freely associated states, I'm sure. But in the southern part of the Pacific, the US just has no real day-to-day basis, no real day-to-day presence in the lives of the average person. And I think that if the US is serious about the Pacific, that's something that needs to change.
Great. We'll have to get you back to talk about that project and at some course. So we've got some questions, and thank you to everyone in the audience who's put questions in. Sometimes the hardest thing of being the compere here is when you don't get questions. But we've got a terrific two questions from, and I ask you, Henrietta, the first question is posed by a person whose name is Elise, and I'll read the question out, which is, security cooperation is sometimes seen as militarizing the region as a whole. Do you think Pacific Island countries can benefit from it, or is it only endangering the ocean of peace? And I guess that's sort of within the context of the militarization, the military basing that Joanne referenced in the talk, but also something that emerged in the Pacific Island Forum last week of something called the Pacific Policing Initiative, where the Pacific leaders endorsed a concept that will be funded by Australia for a training kind of hub in Brisbane, training hubs in the region, a standby deployable force that's able to move at the drop of a hat to deal with catastrophes. Clearly, there is a militarizing, a securitizing of the region. You know, to come back to Elise's question, do you think Pacific Island countries can benefit from it, or is it actually endangering this? The ocean of peace, as she so evocatively calls it.
Yeah, thanks, Gordon, and thanks to you and USIP for having me. I think that there's kind of two big issues there. The first is militarization, and the second is policing. And I'll come back to policing. But I think Demilitarization has a long legacy in the Pacific Islands region, and that is not forgotten by Pacific Island peoples and states. If we're thinking about the unexploded ordinances that are still in Solomon Islands and Palau and that greatly affect people's lives today, if we're thinking about the 318 nuclear tests that were conducted in the Pacific Islands region, that again still have health effects to this day. They've dislocated people from their homes. All of those things are very still remembered legacies of militarization in the region. And I don't think we can forget about that when we're talking about contemporary militarization. As Joanne pointed out, like the type of militarization that's in the region, who actually has the bases, are France and the US, and to a lesser extent, Australia, supporting military bases in the region. And so I think that we need to be really cognizant of how militarization looks in the region and how Pacific Island states are taking that. Things like AUKUS also look very militarized, particularly when contrasted against the South Pacific Nuclear Free Zone Treaty or the Rarotonga Treaty. So I think that Pacific Island states as well also feel that there's a threat if there's increased militarization. Places like Guam do feel like the tip of the spear. They feel like places that might get at first attacked. And so they feel like something that is going to negatively affect them, harm them, be an existential threat, when it's actually none of this militarization is any of their asking. None of this conflict is anything that they've asked for. I think we also need to be concerned about excessive militarization in our support to the region. When we think about the Fijian military, we know that the Fijian military is the biggest proponent of gender-based violence in Fiji, and so any support to the Fijian military actually does have a negative effect. So that's something to be really cognizant of when we're thinking about excessive militarization of the region. On the policing side of things, I think that's quite a different story. I think the Pacific has been calling for increased support for policing. And as you well know, Gordon, both Australia and New Zealand have really long-standing programs for policing support. We know that transnational crime is increasing in the region. We know that there are policing issues to deal with, and so that they really are required. But I guess the Pacific Policing Initiative that was proposed by Australia and was discussed last week at the Pacific Islands Forum is really one of those reactive responses, as Joanne talked about, to Chinese policing in Solomon Islands and Kiribati, also in Fiji, but it's been there since 2012. There were discussions about something called PSELEC, Pacific Law Enforcement Cooperation, back in 2018. And there was consultation about what would work. And I think the conversation that was had at that time was very much, don't take this to Australia, don't take this out of the region. And so I guess I was personally surprised to see this come up as something that's going to happen in Pinkenba and Brisbane. And I think a lot of other Pacific Island states were surprised as well. I think it seemed like a reaction in the way that Australia was not necessarily consulting in the way that it should have. It wasn't necessarily endorsed. Well, it was endorsed by the Pacific Island states. They said that they needed, I'm just reading it out here, further national consultation, and they further directed the development of an implementation plan that would take into account the outcomes of national consultations. And I think that means that not all states are particularly happy with it. I think it has really big concerns for the absorptive capacity of Pacific Island states. We're talking about places like Niue, which have 14 COPs. If you take one of them out for 6 months, you can't backfill, and it really does take out a large percentage of your local policing force. So I think we really need to be thinking about, as Joanne said, you know, if we're doing a reactive program, what are the unintended consequences of that, and how can we think more carefully about the type of support that we're providing, because, as I said, Australia has a long history of policing support, and that is really well respected. So I'm not sure we needed to panic about this one. Sarah. Oh, you're on mute.
I've managed to get through the month of September without doing the mute unmute, so it was going to end at some point. So that's a terrific answer. And I think, I mean, I was trying to calculate 8% of the Niue police is one police officer as well. And something that you know, we sort of comes across from a lot of research in the Pacific that you've led on, Henrietta, you've led on, Joanne, is not all policing is done by people who are in police uniforms as well. It's actually quite a limited amount as well. And it's an absorptive capacity, but also a kind of a, how much training does one need element as well. It's a great answer. We've got, thank you to Jonah Bach and David Treacher, who've come up with some good questions as well. I'm going to ask Jonah's question first. And as usual, happy to kind of, one of you can elect which one to answer this. So Jonah asks, aside from not wanting to get caught in a geopolitical tug of war between the US and its partners and China, what other interest areas are the PIC Pacific Island countries not aligned with the US? Like, what are the areas they're not aligned with? I mean, you mentioned nuclear legacy issues, something my colleague Camilla Poli has written a lot about in issues being a kind of litmus test on the kind of US-Pacific relationships. But Joanne, Henrietta, you know, the floor is yours as to who would like to answer this question with Joanne about what other interest areas are Pacific Island countries not aligned with the US? Then we'll take David's question.
Okay, I'll start, but Henrietta might want to add something because she was a Fulbright scholar in the US not long ago, so she's probably got thoughts from what she heard during her time, particularly in Hawaii. Look, as you mentioned, the nuclear legacy continues to be an issue, and the difficulty that we've seen, particularly in Marshall Islands, and that, you know, that really held up the COFA negotiations in Marshall Islands, the unresolved issue of compensation and remediation for the nuclear testing in Marshall Islands, continues to be an issue. So yes, the nuclear issue is huge, and I think people often forget how much lived experience that the Pacific has of actually what it's like to have a nuclear weapon go off in your backyard, and that those memories are still very fresh. So, you know, as Henrietta rightly mentioned, things like the initiatives like the AUKUS announcement, although they are for nuclear-powered submarines, and the submarines, the nuclear reactor will be hermetically sealed and not able to be opened theoretically. Just the idea that more nuclear-powered and nuclear technologies is going to be traversing the region is causing great angst. We also need to remember that the US is still a colonial power in the Pacific, and that, you know, is a source of tension. Particularly, there's great work coming out of Guam by our friend Ken Cooper, who's a professor at the University of Guam, has published an array of excellent work on this, and the concerns that the Chamorro people have about where Guam is being positioned in future military planning about any kind of conflict that may occur with China. That I think they describe Guam as the tip of the spear for the US's response to China, in particular over a Taiwan contingency. And, you know, the fact that the Chamorro people have been displaced from their land, that the huge amount of land that is owned in Guam by the US military, and the environmental consequences that has had. There's less issue in American Samoa, has less issues with militarization because American Samoa is further from the front lines of any potential conflict. But again, American Samoa is another US colony. And, you know, it's not politically correct these days. You know, the US and others don't like to describe them as colonies. They like to describe them as territories, but they are still colonies. And that does have an impact that is noticed by other Pacific Island countries that the US is denying their fellow islanders self-determination. And there's been concern about what the US might, how the US might use those two territories. For example, in the Pacific Islands Forum, they're both seeking associate membership of the Pacific Islands Forum. And there has been disquiet amongst other Pacific island countries about what will that mean? Is that just sort of letting the US in through the back door as a member of the forum? And are we then going to have the US throwing its weight around in the forum, which has been such a vital avenue for the Pacific collective diplomacy over the last, what is it, 50 years. But, Henrietta, you might want to add something based on your experience.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to add two things. The first is absolutely about your point about independence and the areas that are seeking independence. And we know that there are a number of places in the Pacific that are seeking self-determination. And I think that US alignment with other countries can affect that. So we noticed that at the moment there's not a lot of discussion around what's happening in New Caledonia with the riots where Kanaki are seeking independence. And I think a lot of that is to do with both Australia and the US's alliance with France, and France trying to use New Caledonia as a central point of their Indo-Pacific strategy. And I think that that really does have an impact in the Pacific Island countries, where the Pacific Island Forum was built on the notion of independence and self-determination. So I think that's a really key point. And I think the other one is, I think it's a little bit nuanced, but I think that when the US is talking about climate change and when the Pacific is talking about climate change, I think they're actually talking about slightly different aspects. So we'll give the US credit for, in the US Pacific Partnership, talking a lot about the 2050 strategy and highlighting climate change. And that was really good because it was what Pacific Island states were asking for. And I saw Pacific Island states really active in that negotiation. But I think when the US is talking about climate change and the ways to deal with climate change, a lot of the discussion domestically in the US is around the use of nuclear power. And I think when it comes to the Pacific Islands' view on nuclear, it's all nuclear that they're not very supportive of. So we're talking about the Fukushima wastewater release was not very... it was not taken very well in the Pacific Islands region. We're talking about the nuclear-powered submarines. So it's not just nuclear missiles that the US, that the Pacific is not very happy with, but all nuclear because of the effects on the Pacific Ocean. And so I think when we're talking about climate change, there's a bit of a difference about how the US and the Pacific see the way to deal with climate change. So I would say that that's a point to deal with.
Yeah. Great. And it also gets, I think, to the how terms that are known have multiple meanings depending upon the person who says them and the person who hears them. You know, security is another one of these phrases. When the Pacific Island Forum has made used the word security, it's sometimes made in the context of kind of human security. Whereas whenever maybe Australia or the United States mentioned security, it has a more kind of militarized or sort of policialized inflection. David Treacher from New Zealand Embassy this goes on neatly onto to your last observation about climate change, Henrietta, and it's a really good point, which is you've not talked very much this far about climate change. To what extent do you consider partners' policies on climate change to affect their statecraft in Pacific Island countries? So how much is what they're doing at home impacting abroad or in the Pacific? Henrietta.
Yeah. Great question, kia ora, David. I think that climate change is absolutely the most, according to the Boyd Declaration, the most significant issue for Pacific Island states. And so in this current geopolitical climate, there is no way that that any statecraft partner can talk to the Pacific Island states without discussing climate change. They just won't be seen as a trusted partner. But I think it goes a lot back to what Joanne was saying about announcements and deliverables and about having that integrity to actually deliver on what you say you're going to do. And so I think we saw a little bit of distrust, I think, of Australia after years and years of almost denying climate change and refusing to have climate change discussed, particularly at the 2019 Pacific Islands Forum under the Small Island States Tuvalu Declaration, which never got through because there was no consensus at the Pacific Islands Forum because Australia stopped it. And so there was a lot of distrust for a long time about Australia and climate change. And I think that now the new Albanese government is talking more about climate change. It's really putting efforts into the Pacific Resilience Fund. It's talking about doing COP31 with Pacific Island states. I think there's still a little bit of hesitancy by Pacific Island states as to, is Australia actually going to go through with this? Are they actually going to do it in a way that is supportive of Pacific Island states? Because I think Pacific Island states still see that Australia is still developing new coal and gas plants, and that really is going against, that is their domestic policy going against what they're saying in their foreign policy about agreeing with Pacific Island states and supporting their greatest existential threats. So I think that's probably what I would say is about how climate change affects statecraft in Pacific Island countries. I think there's a lot of hesitancy from Pacific Island states around our statecraft partners doing what they say they're going to do.
Great.
Joanne, did you want to add to that?
I'm going to because we've actually got to kind of sort of momentum with questions, which is great. We're going to get into the rapid fire round pretty soon. We've got 5 minutes left in the podcast series that I did. I remember the most kind of jaw dropping or barbecue stopping interview we did was with a researcher, Robitesh Kant, from the University of Griffith University. And he did a kind of research project where they asked people from Pacific Island states, you know, their policies on climate change. He said, well, when they go to China, they actually don't mention climate change that much in terms of the ask. It's about infrastructure. Remember, it was really kind of scrambling idea from it, so it just came to mind. And this ties in with a question from Andrew Harding, which has just arrived in, which is directly related to China, to the PRC. Andrew's question is this: what's the right balance for the United States in expressing concerns about the PRC when engaging with Pacific Island countries? Is there a red line? How best to discuss US interests of countering the PRC? So like, how does one balance? This whole statecraft is about balancing different interests, but I'd ask you to try to answer quickly, and then we'll try rapidly, and then we'll try to get to another question before you go in.
Yeah, well, I would say that the US and Australia and other partners need to be honest with the Pacific about their legitimate strategic concerns. And here it's you know, recognising that Pacific Island countries are savvy. They know what's going on. You can treat them like a partner, not like a recipient. And you can say, look, we're worried about this because of this. The Pacific knows that Australia, the US and others are worried about China. At the same time, we need to recognise that they don't necessarily share all our concerns. And you could see this, I mean, the most obvious example of this that just rolled off in the last week is, as Henrietta mentioned, at the forum leaders meeting the week before last, there was the big announcement of the Pacific Policing Initiative that Australia is going to fund for $400 million initially over 5 years. Now, Australia would have seen that as a fantastic win. You know, we're going to counter Chinese policing efforts in the Pacific. And then what, yesterday, there was the China Pacific Islands Policing Cooperation Symposium, I can't remember what exactly it was called, over in China, and a whole array of Pacific police officials were there. You know, the Pacific is showing us that they are not willing to be forced to choose sides between the US and its partners in Australia on the one side and China on the other. And, you know, it's a really neat demonstration about how hard it is to win at statecraft if winning is acquiring all the influence at the expense of China in the Pacific. So yes, we should speak to the Pacific like the grown-ups that they are about our concerns, but we need to recognise that they don't necessarily share them. They do in some respects, but in others they see it as an opportunity, quite justifiably, to access a range of assistance from partners who haven't been as interested in the region possibly ever and as they are now.
Makes you wonder if there's any police officers doing any policing in the Pacific, if they're either off in China or they're in Tonga, the Pacific Islands Chief of Police, or they're going to Brisbane or one of these regional hubs. Final question, real quick. Because we're running out of time, and I want to thank everyone in the audience for tuning in to this. It was well worth the time and well worth, I think, Joanne and Henrietta getting up so early for us. My question is this, which is, what specific advice do you have for a diplomat, a police officer, a contractor that is going off to the Pacific in order to do statecraft, in order to try to engage in this game of power and influence that you're talking about? 30 seconds.
Listen, say yes to everything and advance those relationships and connections by being your genuine self. Learn the history before you go. Learn the history of the country that you're going to, but also your country and how it's engaged with that country. Humility is absolutely valued. Relationships are the most important thing to have. And the last thing I would say is go outside of capital cities, leave that air conditioning and that elite bubble, and just go and be part of that country and really, really properly engage and develop those relationships. It's probably all I'd say.
That was great. Joanne, thank you very much. Henrietta, thank you very much. Thank you to everyone who's joined us. My name's Gordon Peake. I've really enjoyed moderating this, and you can find details of this terrific research project on the University of Adelaide website. We'll post the links to everyone. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.